This is David Green. I'm the co-founder of Fearless Media, and I am your host here on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we take on all the political issues, even those complicated ones that might be dividing your own family these days. So we're in the third week of August now, and this week a political dynasty may have fallen. This was no surprise, but Congresswoman Liz Cheney lost her Republican primary for her seat in the House of Representatives. She lost it overwhelmingly to Trump-endorsed attorney Harriet Hegeman. This despite Cheney's reliably conservative voting record and also longtime support for the Cheney family in the state of Wyoming. So let's start there. With our crew, our left, right, and center panel, I'm your host at your center. On the left, we are rejoined by Elizabeth Bruning, staff writer at The Atlantic. And on the right, Tara Setmayer, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project, former GOP communications director on Capitol Hill, and a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Hello to you both.
Hi there.
Hello.
So this was not a surprise at all, I would say. I mean, Cheney lost support of dare I say, the new Republican establishment, which is kind of scary to say, when she voted to impeach President Trump and took on this really outspoken leadership role in the January 6th committee. I guess just to start broadly, Tara, how would you describe Liz Cheney's legacy in Congress?
Well, just the fact that she comes from a legacy political family that was political royalty in the Republican Party for decades.
Cheney goes back to the Ford White House, right?
Absolutely. And the first time that her father was elected to Congress in 1978, I believe, out of Wyoming, and as, you know, SecDef, vice president. I mean, the Cheney dynasty was one that was up there with the Bushes and, you know, the Reagan era. And to see her in just a few short years go from Republican leadership to being ousted by almost 40 points in a primary in a state of Wyoming, that's like a Kennedy losing in Massachusetts. It doesn't happen. But it did this time simply because she committed the cardinal sin of not supporting Donald Trump's election lie. She has a 92%+ voting record for Donald Trump's agenda while he was president.
And voted against his first impeachment. I mean,
Correct. Which, you know, those of us who followed that would say, you know, what were you thinking? Like many others. I believe Adam Kinzinger also voted against the first impeachment, wrongly, in my opinion. And so, you know, her policy record, her bona fides as a conservative Republican are unequivocal. And yet, all it took was calling out Donald Trump, standing up for the truth after January 6th and saying enough is enough is enough. And I don't think that she initially anticipated that Republican leadership like Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, who also criticized Trump at the time after January 6th, I don't think she anticipated that they would turn around and hightail it right back to him and give him cover for it.
She thought they would have her back, that they were kind of on the same team.
I think she did initially. But then when how quickly they went right back, she said, you know what? This is absolutely against all of my beliefs, against my family's beliefs, against my entire existence in public service. I'm going to stand up and do the right thing here, even if it costs me my political career in Congress. And I think that's admirable. Now, you know, I know a lot of people and a lot of Democrats have admired her for her stance on this specifically, even though politics makes for strange bedfellows because the Cheneys were despised by the left, by a lot of people for, you know, we can argue what those reasons were and whether they're legitimate or not. No,
starting the second war in Iraq and maybe
right,
changing the world.
Stuff. Yeah, right. All that. Her positions on, you know, on torture and everything else. I mean, obviously that she is in complete opposite of what the progressive or democratic agenda is, but it shows you that in this moment that we're in as a country, that defending our democracy and standing up for the truth and defending our election integrity and standing up to what Trumpism has turned our country into and the attacks on our democracy supersedes those policy differences. And I think that's rather extraordinary. It gives me hope that as a country, we can come together behind just at least that basic tenet of making sure that threats to our democracy are stopped. And Liz Cheney now, in my opinion, has more power than she did before she lost her election.
Oh, interesting. After losing by 40 points in her own state.
Sure, that's sure. Because she no longer has the constraints of Congress. She will use the power she has until she's out at the rest of her term to finish her commitments to the January 6th committee, where she has been an absolute star. And then from this point on, she can be the Republican conscience, the mirror that the Republican leadership does not want to look into, calling them out constantly and forcing them to answer for the hypocrisy of supporting Donald Trump if they claim to be Republicans.
Tara, you sound hopeful, optimistic, sort of like this is a potential positive moment. Liz, how are you capturing this moment?
I mean, I don't see a huge amount of reason for optimism at this particular juncture. I'm not especially depressed about Liz Cheney's loss. I don't think it signals anything good. I wouldn't have thought that her persistence signaled anything particularly good either. You know, Liz Cheney she was not a welcome presence in the House for me as a leftist, for all of the reasons that, you know, I think we've set forth pretty honestly here. She's a very right-leaning politician. I mean, she was on the right vanguard of the Republican Party for a long time. She happened to take up the vanguard on, you know, leading the way a little bit on this investigation into January 6th. And I mean, that makes sense. She got scared. It was just probably pretty terrifying to have a bunch of freaks storm the Capitol while you were inside of it.
But you don't see that as courage. You see that as being scared and responding to fear. I mean, a lot of people see that as like her standing up and saying, like, I could lose my entire political career over this.
Yes, yes, I understand it. I understand it. However, if you look at the context in which her career has unfolded, Liz Cheney has been responsible for quite a lot of people being terrified and faced with armies of invaders, right? I mean, she has repeatedly voted for provisions that would extend America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That was her continuing her father's legacy in Iraq. She has also been, until this bipartisan gun bill in 2022, at least, a strong supporter, she says, of the Second Amendment, i.e. of arming Americans. We now live in the world that kind of politics has created. We live in a world of mass shootings and of generalized sort of terror of mass shootings. We've just gone through Uvalde, the 4th of July shootings, the Buffalo shootings. I mean, I don't even need to list them all. We've already had several shootings that were extremely disturbing for the public. Just this year, we're in the midst of a death penalty trial for the Parkland shooter right now. I mean, and that's the world that people, politicians like Liz Cheney, created for us. So I'm not terribly sympathetic, no.
Do you think Democrats who celebrated what she did on the January 6th committee and have kind of become part of her fan base, do you think they realize her voting record and how fundamentally opposed to a lot of what they believe in she is? And if they don't know that, is that a failing of, I don't know, us in the media for just focusing on one side of her story and this narrative of that she's the, you know, the anti-Trump hero?
You know, probably they don't really have any sense of her actual voting record. And probably it is to some degree, if not, mainly the fault of the press, because, you know, we want to write with a hero. We want to write with a main character, especially when you have a character as strong as Trump, you know, a lead like that. You want to set up an opponent for him. I understand that narrativizing tendency in writing, but you know, at the same time, someone, you know, running afoul of what Trump would prefer doesn't necessarily mean they're on the side of the good and right.
Well, let me just fall right into the trap that I criticized and ask you, Tara, is this a victory for Donald Trump, Liz Cheney's political demise in Wyoming for the moment?
Well, on the face of it, sure, because he had a revenge tour and an enemies list, and she was at the top of it, and he took her down and took her out of office. And in his mind, that's a win to him. My optimism here is, I'm not Pollyanna on this. It's my optimism is that we have someone now who is credible, who comes from the perspective of you cannot question her conservative or Republican record, who will speak out and force the Republicans to have to answer for it. That is good for the conversation going into 2024 and could wound Donald Trump in the primary when they're constantly reminded of what he did and how he did it and what it cost the country. So from that perspective, do I think this is somehow going to rehab the Republican Party? Absolutely not. I think the party is on a highway to hell with gasoline draws on, unfortunately. And I'm not sure how you bring that back right now, unless there were more Liz Cheneys, unfortunately. So that's where that part, I just wanted to be clear about what my optimism was. And in this case, I also feel like it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. You know, we can't, you know, the policy differences that we all have are moot if the democracy goes under. If the Republic and the great experiment that is America no longer exists, it's not going to make a bit of difference how we feel about tax cuts or, you know, pro-choice or pro-life or gun control. None of that matters if the Republic goes under.
Well, I mean, but isn't that assuming that the policy fights can be on hold for, you know, an indefinite period of time? I mean, Liz,
well,
let me ask you about
not on hold, though. Not on hold. I mean, we're still having those policy fights in Congress, obviously.
Sure.
But I'm saying, like, you know, when it comes time to have to support certain people in office in order to maintain order, like, look what's happening in Utah. Democrats were able to make a decision not to run a Democratic candidate to support Evan McMullen to try to take out Mike Lee. Like, that's the kind of politics, strategizing that we need in this moment right now. And then you live to fight another day.
But what does that say about our politics today? If you're making the argument, I don't necessarily disagree with it because I think our democracy is pretty damn important, but it's like you're making the argument like support this politician who voted against restoring parts of the Voting Rights Act, who voted against expanding the Affordable Care Act, who voted not to impeach Donald Trump, in the first impeachment scandal and Ukraine, but saying like we need to support people like Liz Cheney to save
right.
our democracy. I mean, Liz, are you on board with that?
Right. I mean, it's just acknowledging that, basically the government has disintegrated to the point that, you're asking people to vote in a sense to preserve the act of voting.
Is that okay? I mean, maybe we've reached that moment in our country.
I mean, how am I supposed to believe that me voting will preserve the act of voting at that point? I mean, that's the level of, total disintegration of, governmental legitimacy, I think you're operating at when you start to ask people, when you start to say your political activity at this point actually has to be oriented towards trying to use the levers of representative democracy to prevent despotism. My question is, can the levers of representative democracy prevent despotism?
They have so far.
Yeah.
I mean, well,
right?
have we ever had a serious effort at a despotic takeover of the United States and we have simply voted them out?
Not quite, but we're facing it now. Right, because the experiment has worked thus far because of the got guardrails and people's decision to not allow those types of forces to push through. I mean, we've had that pressure on our country where you had some authoritarian leanings and things like that in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah, sure,
so
sure.
Not quite as stark as it is now, but I mean, we've had those pressures before and we've beaten them back, and we are now in a unique moment.
I was under the impression that in the 1930s, what saved America from rank fascism was actually a good deal of socialism in the form of the New Deal.
But it was still through the representative democracy, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But maybe it's not through voting for Liz Cheney. Maybe it's through voting for Bernie Sanders.
Well, considering there's only a couple hundred thousand people in Wyoming, I don't know that is one state in one at-large seat is going to make the difference there when we're talking about people voting.
My point
it.
Would it's, just be, you know, you can only tell people they're in a critical moment for the preservation of democracy for so long before they start to say, well, how is this thing that's basically disintegrating and fragile actually able to protect itself just by my pulling a lever? And that's a reasonable question. And I think the answer to it is, well, there have to be things happening politically that stabilize democracy. You can't just put the right people in power to do investigations and sit on committees. There have to be material policies put in place that stabilize the population and create fertile ground for a deep-rooted democracy. That's why the New Deal was able to shore up American democracy. That's my position.
That's... You know, you're talking about like a frightening next phase.
That's a dangerous path, but that's a different conversation about whether our current democracy or constitutional republic is in its current form works. That's a whole different conversation. But until then, this is the system we have, and it starts with who you vote into office.
Well, we end a lot of segments on this show by talking about the potential demise of our democracy, which I guess is unfortunate, but it's I guess that's the moment we're living in. All right, we'll be back with more from Tara Settmayer of the Lincoln Project and Liz Bruning of The Atlantic. We're going to talk more about this moment, not just in our country, but this moment in the Republican Party. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media and your center on the show. On the right, we have Tara Settmayer, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. On the left, Elizabeth Bruning, staff writer at The Atlantic. And we've been talking about Liz Cheney's record in Congress, where she goes from here, also the state of our democracy right now. And I want to bring a special guest in to talk about all of this. It's Nicole Hemmer. She's associate professor of history, director of the Rogers Center for the Study of the Presidency at Vanderbilt University. Also just wrote another book. This one is called Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Nikki, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we just pick up where we left off? I would just love your thoughts as you were listening on our discussion of whether our democracy can survive and the whole conversation that Tara and Liz were having about, is it about putting the right people in office, or if it's just going to be investigations, that's not going to solve the larger issues. How were you reacting to all that?
Well, I certainly agree that it has to be more than voting, that just going in and pulling a lever every 2 to 4 years is not going to be enough to rebuild democracy. You really have to work from the grassroots up, and you have to make the affirmative case that democracy is something worth saving. I mean, if we're talking about the 1930s and the New Deal, there were plenty of Americans who thought that fascism, dictatorship, all of that sounded pretty good. And it really required a wholesale campaign to make the case for democracy to help alleviate, as Liz was talking about, the material conditions that people found themselves in, to begin to restore that faith in democracy after it had gone through a pretty rough patch in the United States. So I do agree that it has to be a much broader effort.
Aren't people making that argument today? I mean, who do you look to make the argument in some powerful way that will get through to you know, the majority, if not hopefully all of the American public?
I think people are making that argument, the pro-democracy argument, on a broad level, but I think it has to be married with these programs that are helping to shore up people's material reality. And it has to not just be on the national level. It has to be on the state and local level as well, that is where people really feel the impact of democracy when it's working well, that it's rebuilding institutions, whether it's local schools or local libraries or local city councils, that by rebuilding those, then you can have an effect on the national level. But I think starting from the bottom up instead of the top down may be one place to refocus attention.
You're saying we need to go back to basics and have basic civics lessons at the local level about the importance of institutions and school boards. And wow, it's really going back to the basics.
Well, right. And exactly this idea that you can't take it as a given that everyone is bought into these systems and these institutions. You have to make the case for them.
Yeah. And that's a good point.
True.
Because there are a lot of people who believe in it who are like, what? You're crazy for not believing in democracy. Why wouldn't you believe in it? It's the system that works. This is what we are as Americans. And, you know, just scoff at people who doubt it.
And we now live in a period where there are intellectuals who are openly making the case, as in the 1930s and early 1940s, for fascism. I mean, there are stories in the New York Times and other major New York magazines about, you know, intellectuals in New York City who are having parties where they're openly discussing fascist ideas and the problems with liberalism, the problems with liberal democracy, and the reasons that reactionary alternatives are better. I mean, this is something that's happening in the United States.
But let's not forget that even in the 30s, you had FDR, who showed Gabriel over the White House, which was a pretty pro-fascist movie and a hit at the time in the country. And you also had a Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in New York City. So, you know, these are not new concepts that have been introduced into the American zeitgeist. It's just a matter of what dominated the conversation at the time and what's happening now and whether people believe in supporting representative democracy the way we have it, which side wins out. The fact that we're having these conversations again is quite fascinating, frankly.
But I feel like that is where we have to start. I mean, by saying, like, these conversations about our form of government have come up in the past, and there is, like, we need to recognize and honor that this is an important conversation to have. Because I think so many people are just saying, like, oh, you support Trump and he's trying to tear down democracy. You're just crazy. I'm not even going to have that conversation because you're nuts. And it's like we need to all come together and say, like, that our democracy can be at risk, and it's worth having a debate and fighting for the system of government that we believe in. Because I think a lot of people don't even think that that's a conversation that's even needed. It's like worthless.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that it's also worth pointing to the places in American history where ideas around fascism or anti-democratic ideas have taken hold. We've talked about the 30s and 40s, but there were parts of the United States up through the mid-1960s that were essentially despotic regimes, particularly for Black Americans. And studying the efforts that people who were living in those despotic regimes undertook in order to make the case for a broader democracy and their right to vote and their right to full citizenship, there are plenty of ways that we can find antecedents to this in the past in the United States instead of looking abroad to foreign experiences. And if we can focus our attention on those, I think we would be in better stead.
So it's history that might convince people that this is a conversation worth having, because I think there are a lot of people who say, like, why should I even give the time of day to people who, you know, support the idea of democracy being bad, who don't believe in elections, who are going to question every single fair election? It's like you don't even want to legitimize those arguments. But giving a history lesson might say, like, you need to, because these are serious questions and this is an important moment.
And it can pull us out of the heat of the present examples, right? By taking a step back and looking at different eras where people have grappled with these questions, the temperature isn't quite so hot if you can take a step back and look at some historical examples and legacies.
Turn to historians when the temperature gets too hot, which we're doing today with you, Nikki, well, I want to ask you, I mean, speaking of taking the long view, like, you know, a lot of people are, as we were talking about, seeing this Liz Cheney loss in Wyoming as very much part of the Trump versus Liz Cheney narrative, who wins, who loses. But can you kind of fit this moment into the long story and long journey of the Republican Party?
Sure. I mean, there was a real switch that happened in the Republican Party in the 1990s. You know, in the 1980s, there was this talk of a kind of big tent conservatism, where people were talking about Reagan Democrats. Reagan was winning these massive landslide elections when he ran for president. And by the time you get to the 1990s, the dominant idea is not Reagan Democrats, but RINOs, Republicans in name only. This notion that you had to cleanse the party of people who didn't fit ideologically. And we tend to think of that as something, for instance, that Newt Gingrich is spearheading, which he was. But even when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House from 95 through 99, he was somebody who was constantly facing pressures from his right, from a group of Republicans who called themselves true believers, who were challenging, say, reopening the government after the government shut down in 95 and 96. And so you have this process that has been happening on the right where anyone who is perceived as moderate gets pushed out. There was a big push for that again in 2010, and we're seeing it again around Donald Trump. So this is part of a pattern or a style of politics that has been dominant on the right for now 25 to 30 years.
But what happened? I mean, even if sort of the Trump movement had its roots maybe in the true believers and its roots in the people to the right of Newt Gingrich, what has given them so much power and sway today that we see Liz Cheney lose by 40 points in Wyoming? What has changed, even if we're saying that the roots of this were a couple decades ago?
So I think a few things have changed. One, the primary system for the party has gotten much more focused on purity politics. You're seeing a lot of turnover happening, not in the general election, but in the primaries. And then the media environment in which Republican politics is operating has gotten much more intense. You know, if you're talking about the mid-1990s, you have Rush Limbaugh, you're getting the very beginnings of Fox News, but you don't have this sort of all-encompassing right-wing media that is incentivizing candidates who are further and further to the right, or in this case, more and more pro-Trump. And those shifts have, I think, at least fed into the changes we're seeing in the Republican Party today.
You said incentivizing. What does the media do to incentivize like a candidate or politician?
So a lot of different things. One is, who do you give airtime? Who do you brand as the true conservative? Who is it that you hold up as a rhino, as a liberal in conservative clothing? Who do you sort of point your attacks at? Liz Cheney is actually a great example of this. She has come to stand in for a whole class of Republican elites who betrayed Donald Trump, who betrayed the cause and the movement. And when that is coming, not just from Fox News, but every podcast that you listen to and social media sites and blogs that you're tuned into, when you're hearing it from all corners, that becomes that politician's reputation. And so it incentivizes you in the sense that if you are a candidate, you don't want to get crossways with the conservative media ecosystem because you can lose a lot of support that way.
Tara, I want to bring you in here. I mean, you're an example of someone who was a very active Republican, I think, but tell me if I'm wrong, you consider yourself a true conservative. You've said that you didn't leave the party left you. I mean, if the media were branding people like you who share your political views as the true Republican, would that create a different situation in today's environment?
Of course it would, because we wouldn't be the heretics or the apostates. The Trumpers would have been. And we noticed that, and that was one of the shocking parts of watching this devolve with the Republican Party starting back in 2015 and 16, as more and more embraced Donald Trump and did not hold him accountable for all of the things that he was standing for and things that he would say and advocate for that were anathema to Republican orthodoxy. Starting with attacking John McCain and military families and this idea of indecency, a lot of that was shocking to think that there weren't more Republicans who stood up and said, wait, that's not okay. And then, of course, going into different policy prescriptions where he was, you know, all about isolationism and protectionism against global trade. Like, these are things that were just basic Republican principles. And we're like, what is going on? And no one held him accountable for it. And instead, they lionized him and created this cult of personality. And that superseded principle. And so for me, watching this happen over the years, I can trace back to the inflection points now. Obviously, now that I've stepped out of it, I came to my political maturation during the 90s. I lived through all of that. I worked on a lot of those Republican campaigns in the 90s. I went to college at George Washington University. So I was here at the epicenter of power during the Newt Gingrich era and the Contract with America and the rise of Republicans taking over Congress for the first time in 40 years. And I can see how it went from those policies and focusing on that to the rise of, there is, in my opinion, a direct correlation to the rise of Fox News, talk radio, social media, and the more extreme language and almost indoctrination and propaganda coming out of the right-wing media ecosystem. And it was all in the name of countering the liberal culture, you know, political correctness.
But isn't there a chicken and egg question here? I mean, yes, the media obviously, like, you know, can get a brand more visibility, but it's like, does the media create the cult of personality, or does the cult of personality happen and the media covers it? And, you know, I just think back to just the number of voters who I would talk to about, you know, why they support Donald Trump. And it would often be so personal. It would be like, I don't feel good about myself in my own life. And this guy's telling me that, like, I can say whatever I want, I can do whatever I want, and I'm not going to be judged for it. And I guess, Liz, like, my question is, like, who is a version of that in the Democratic Party? Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think of John Fetterman right now in Pennsylvania, but it's like, who can connect in that way and be a cult of personality that can draw voters away from someone like Donald Trump, assuming that the media is not the only thing responsible here?
We don't have somebody like that on the left at this point. I think the last closest thing we had was something like Bernie Sanders, and he was like that, but as a youth candidate. Not a broad mainstream candidate. I mean, he did surprisingly well in the 16 primaries. You know, he's a 40-something% of the vote there. Nevertheless, you know, that was the high watermark. Trump, he occupies a special place, I think, in the right-wing imagination. I think the main service he provides, sort of what Tara was hinting at here, is, you know, in the right-wing imagination, I think there's this sense that the liberal culture, the liberal media, the liberal tastemakers look down on right-wing people, that they mock them, that they think they're stupid and tasteless and ridiculous, and just abhor their whole way of life. And Trump was someone who turned it back around on them, who mocked them, who laughed at them, who owned the libs. And that was worth everything. It was almost worth more than any single policy just to own the libs. When Trump would say things like, the wall just got 10 feet higher. I mean, that was obviously ridiculous, but it did make liberals extremely emotional and very, very upset. And even now, Trump is better than any right-wing politician at making liberal politicians, liberal celebrities, liberal commentators freak out. And I think he will always have huge value for that reason.
And he's created a cottage industry of others who take up the mantle of owning the libs. It's all about that. It's right, and we see that because of the access to information that we have now that we didn't have 20 years ago. Being able to just sit there and watch these podcasts and live streams right in the palm of your hand. You didn't have that before. And that is a really powerful tool. Mass communication is a really powerful tool. And we've seen the result of that with the indoctrination of millions of people believing that President Biden is not legitimately elected, or that there is a massive conspiracy in Hollywood and in Democrats to sacrifice children and drink their blood and human trafficking. I mean, these conspiracy theories and the cottage industry of people like Alex Jones and others, the reach that they have is extraordinary. And a lot of that is because of the ability of the right-wing ecosystem media culture.
Nikki, I know you're a historian, so we should be asking you more about the past than the future. But I mean, in terms of like what we have a politician with a cult of personality that, you know, trounces other candidates in states like Wyoming. And then we see this again, his candidate beats, you know, an established Republican family by 40 points in a state that has loved the Cheney family for so long. Like, are there other historical lessons that you can point to that might tell us where this is going?
The U.S. has certainly seen cults of personality in the past. They haven't tended to be national politicians. So they've been people like Huey Long in the 1930s or Father Coughlin from the same period. But this kind of cult of personality around a president feels like it's something new. I do think that it points our attention toward what the Democratic Party should be doing in order to shore up its own strength. Because, you know, if you think about all of the things we've been talking about, all of the incentives on the right to support Donald Trump, and the sense that the Republican Party isn't going to change course anytime soon. So what is it that the Democratic Party can do in the mold of somebody like Franklin Roosevelt to restore faith in the Democratic Party, to restore faith in government in the United States? I mean, if there is any sort of cult of personality example, FDR is probably it. He is somebody who Americans would hang his picture in their kitchen. They would hang him on their walls because he was somebody who they felt very personally connected with in a very difficult time in the United States. And he was able to take that kind of sense of connection. He made sure to keep it strong through things like the fireside chats. And he used that faith that Americans had in him to experiment and try to find things that would work to make people's lives better. And I think that's the example of if the Democrats do stumble into a cult of personality, to direct that passion and that energy into something useful and creative rather than something destructive.
Stumble into or maybe actively search for the right person. We're going to have to leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Rogers Center for the Study of the Presidency at Vanderbilt. Thank you so much. Really interesting stuff. It's great having you.
Thank you.
Also been talking with Elizabeth Brunig and Tara Settmeyer, and we're going to be back with back to school COVID and vaccine policies here on Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, your host, coming at you from the center. On the left, we have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic, and on the right, Tara Settmeyer, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. Before we move on, I was so curious. Like, we heard Nikki there talking about FDR being the model of the person Democrats need right now to kind of be the counterweight to Donald Trump. Do you both agree with that, or are there other names on the list?
Well, I would argue that JFK would come to mind for Democrats, and the way that the Kennedys took the country by storm, Camelot, the obsession with the Kennedy family and the First Lady, and obviously the tragic way in which the Kennedy brothers perished in the 60s. But that was a time where I think that a lot of the country was enamored with a huge personality in the presidency in a way that we have not seen since then, at least on the Democratic side. But maybe Bill Clinton a little bit. There was a little hint of that because he was quite savvy, young, and hip, but not quite the same intrigue as we had with the Kennedys, I think, in the 60s.
Liz?
Yeah, I think Reagan, maybe, had a pretty significant cult following. Based on my reading of history and especially on the impressions my family members, Republicans in Texas, still had of Ronald Reagan many years on, I had an interesting mix of family members, New Deal Democrats who had lived through the Dust Bowl, and then, of course, Texan Republicans who had come along after the Great Change in the South. And so, you know, very, very different feelings about Reagan there, but they alerted me to the fact that he had represented something very important to Republicans after the Carter years. And Obama, I think, was an important figure to Democrats. I mean, he was a very important figure to Democrats in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, especially. I don't know if he rises to the level of FDR. I don't know if Americans could ever be enchanted that way again. We're a pretty disenchanted people at this
yeah.
point.
I think that's a very good point.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I love the fact that I picked Democrats and Liz picked Republican stalwart. See,
yeah.
there's hope here.
You know, and I have to, can I just use that as a moment to say, I mean, a lot of listeners have been saying, like, you know, and for good reason, because the show is called Left, Right, and Center. I mean, you know, there are labels in the title of the show, but like labels don't have to apply to our guests all the time. I mean, I don't know. You are a human. You have your own histories and belief systems. And, you know, no one's going to fall into this strict definition of liberal, conservative. And it's just refreshing to...
Well, we weren't ranking best presidents. Were we? just cults of personality.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair.
It is kind of true. Like it, and I want to talk about vaccines for a second, which is one of those issues where I feel like people don't always fall into strict camps. And it's interesting you know, Tara, you brought up the Kennedys. That family has been going through a really tough time because, you know, Robert Kennedy's son, Robert Kennedy Jr., has been one of the biggest advocates for vaccines being unsafe and has been part of the real anti-vaccine community, which a lot of people in the family have been upset about. But, you know, we've got kids going back to school. And, you know, there was all this talk about whether schools would have mandates for COVID vaccines. And, you know, almost unanimously, most have not, although Washington, D.C. has a requirement. But there have been these other topics bubbling up. I mean, scare over polio. There's a case in New York where a federal court just turned down a group of parents who were trying to say that there aren't enough exemptions to get out of vaccines. So this seems to be a conversation that is back. And Tara, I just wonder, should there be limits in the, you know, in this argument that people make about freedom and constitutional rights, should there be limits on what schools, school systems, local governments can require of kids when it comes to vaccinations?
So just before I answer that, to your point about the Kennedy family going through this vaccine issue,
yeah.
The irony of all of this is that it was actually liberal elites who were the anti-vaxxers many years ago. Like they were the leaders of that, coming from, you know, the idea of more natural approaches to doing things and kind of, you know, like the whole Whole Foods crowd, like that area, like that's where a lot of the Jenny McCarthy, remember, she was a big anti-vaxxer.
Yeah.
Like, and it was the Republicans who were like, wait a minute, you guys, like our kids need to be vaccinated in schools and you're contributing to the problems here of spreading certain things because of your liberal beliefs. And so the turn of that has been rather fascinating to watch happen. Just a note on that. As far as vaccine mandates in schools, I mean, obviously as a conservative, I feel like local control is important, especially when it comes to school curriculums and making decisions for policies in those communities, because what works in Newark, New Jersey may not work in Boise, Idaho. You know, that was kind of the politics of prudence here is what how I approach things a lot. You know, Russell Kirk wrote a whole book called that, and I encourage people to read it. I encourage a lot of Republicans to go back and read that, because we're not seeing the politics of prudence right now with some of the decision-making lately around vaccines and public health and the whole COVID era, because it's not based on science a lot of the time. And so it's more on politics, don't tell us what to do, which is not really conservative, that's more libertarian. And so when it comes to local decisions, yeah, I mean, it's up to the local elected school boards if what they feel works there. I personally think there should be a vaccine mandate, just like you have vaccine mandates for other vaccines. All of us got vaccinated before we could go to school. Going to school is something that is part of the law and part of what we mandate here in our country.
But you'd be okay if a local school board somewhere, if they voted and said, let's take all vaccine mandates away from now on because that's what our local community believes in.
I mean, I would personally not be okay with that, no. But if that's what the local, if that's who you voted into office and that's what they decided, well, then either you try to, you know, go for a recall, which is happening here in Northern Virginia where I live. People are getting recalled all the time, or recall efforts all the time. You see it in California and other places. If they're not happy with the result, there are ways within the system to fight back against it. But that's where it becomes, you have to decide who you want in office and which side wins. That's the way it works here. You know, we're not always going to agree, but we saw what happened in Virginia and in New Jersey in the off-year elections, where local control, COVID mandates and policies were really animating factors across party lines in some of these elections in Virginia and New Jersey. And the results were shocking to some people because they didn't expect it would be that animating for people, but it has been. And so I may personally be okay with vaccine mandates. I think that is the prudent response to a public health emergency. And that is very conservative, in my opinion.
Liz, I want to give you the last word here. I know you're vaccinated, but you've written about that you have some complicated feelings around all of this. And one of the things you wrote that I just loved, your writing is beautiful, by the way, but you said one of the unloveliest and least enlightening aspects of contemporary discourse is the tendency to presume that whatever one disagrees with must be very simple, not only simple, but also simply wrong, not only wrong, but also false, argued in bad faith. I got the sense that you were making the argument that if you believe fervently in vaccines, but someone doesn't, that you shouldn't necessarily judge them for that, even if you believe they're putting people at risk.
Yes, people have all kinds of reasons for coming to the conclusions that they do. And I don't instantaneously presume that it's malice or rank stupidity or whatever you want to assume, right? People have all reasons for coming to the conclusions that they do. As I said, people get to where they are in life through some circuitous routes. And, you know, something I've just learned as a reporter, which maybe other people are born knowing intuitively, and I'm an idiot, and it took me some time to learn. But I did learn it through reporting, and I'm glad that I have. It's one of the great privileges of having this job, is that, you know, everybody leads an absolutely incredible life. And you wouldn't believe it. Everybody's story would just absolutely floor you if you sat down and listened to it. And so, yeah, people come away with different conclusions based on who they trust, experiences they've had with medicine, and stuff they've read, and their reasoning, and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's not that people are typically completely immune to persuasion or conversation. It's just that, you know, people have a sense of self and identity. And when you confront them quite brutally with, you know, any kind of argument that is contrary to their sense of self and identity and their personal beliefs, they're going to defend themselves. That's what any of us do. You know, when you have something you strongly believe in or you consider to be a serious personal value and someone confronts it, you know, you defend it. And that's normal and that's to be expected. So oftentimes, I think, you know, if you want to persuade someone, that's a totally reasonable and valid thing to do. You know, we were talking quite a bit about democracy. I think quite a bit of the failure of American democracy at this point is just the presumption that persuasion is impossible or that it's even a bad thing to attempt.
And maybe it starts with learn someone's story, like learn right, what's behind a belief and then sort of go in that way.
Right. Just have a conversation is my suggestion and see where you get. I'm not suggesting that you yourself who are vaccinated or who believe in vaccines should go in entirely open to being persuaded against them or anything like that. I'm just saying that most conversations with most people are less absolutist and less zero sum than they're made out to be, especially on internet discourse.
Love that. All right, so we've reached that time once again for the Left, Right, and Center rants. These are pet peeves from across the political spectrum. And Tara, let me start with you.
So this week, I have to say that this social media trolling war going on between Pennsylvania Senate candidates Fetterman and Dr. Oz has been rather entertaining. I'm here for it to a certain degree. But I also feel like we have devolved into this. Part of our conversation before was about cult of personality, and I feel like this is beneath the dignity of the Senate, where the Senate is really important. It's supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative body, and we have two candidates that are battling each other over snarky comments about who lived in whose basement and how many houses someone has and what crudité is versus a veggie platter. I mean, this is all very entertaining, but I also think that when control of the United States Senate and the future of our democracy is on the line, that at some point there needs to be some seriousness brought back to the conversation. Maybe it's just summer fodder, but I'm hoping that the issues and what's important to voters in Pennsylvania gets back on the ballot post-Labor Day.
I was literally going to rant about the same Senate race.
Oh, my God.
But from a totally different place, Tara. This is amazing. You're saying it's beneath, you know, the Senate race to be having this conversation. I kind of loved it and thought there was a lesson there. And here's what I was going to say. Like, Dr. Oz going into a grocery store, whining about prices and saying he just wants to make himself a crudité. I'm like, seriously? I mean, I love a good crudité. I've used the term at nice restaurants, but if I'm getting ready to watch a Steelers game in my home state, yes, of Pennsylvania, and I go to the grocery store, I'm telling my friends I'm going to grab a veggie tray. And probably no one's going to eat it because they're the thing that's still left over. But like for Fetterman to call out Dr. Oz, I'm like, Democrats, follow Fetterman. You somehow lost this country to a billionaire real estate developer who was somehow able to relate to voters better than you can. Just like, I mean, follow the Fetterman lead. You can be an intellectual. You can fight for human rights. You can fight for the planet. And you can do it without seeming like you're looking down on people like me who eat veggie trays while watching football games. Okay, Liz, you're not going to rant about veggie trays, are you?
No.
Okay. It's all yours.
Welcome to the worst time of the year. It's officially mid-August. This is the dog days of summer before it finally becomes fall. It's the time when the back-to-school stuff is in stores, but not the Halloween stuff. It's absolutely miserable outside. The air is full of mosquitoes, heavy as hell. I wish this time of year did not have to exist, and I will quote one of the worst bands of my childhood, Wake Me Up When September Ends.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. Tara Settmeyer, Elizabeth Brunig, I want to thank both of you. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Alexander Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I am David Green. Come back next week. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.